Mental health and wellness are crucial aspects of well-being. Their understanding and acceptance are vital for the progress of society. In a cultural context, mental health is often shrouded in stigma and misunderstanding, leading to a lack of proper support and care for those affected. Heal Your Mind with Tracy Kotzen is a platform for candid conversations that enlighten and enrich our understanding of mental health and wellness. Join us as we demystify, destigmatize, prioritize, and shine a light on mental health and healing. Heal Your Mind podcast with Tracy Kotzen is hosted by Mental Wellness Initiative and supported by the Ford Foundation.
Good day and welcome to episode 9 of Heal Your Mind with me, Tracy Kotzen. Today in studio, we have Martin Palders, Dr. Ani Nwaneri, and online we have Dr. Shahida Omar, Grant Stewart, and Hazel Friedman. And our conversation today is about understanding South Africa's deep national wounds and the context that that has left us with 2.5 decades later. Gosh, nearly 3 decades later, in fact. Martin Palders is the director of Matrix Men. Dr. Ani is an expert on the NGO sector, particularly with reference to our most impoverished communities. Dr. Shahida Omar is an expert in the children's sector. Grant Stewart is a trauma-informed practitioner, and Hazel Friedman, legendary investigative journalist. It is absolutely a privilege to have all of you with us today. So I'd like to start with you, Hazel. From your perspective as a journalist, and you were on special assignment, you'd won awards for your work. And I think your career has given you a vantage point with which to see the unfolding of the last 30 years and our history as a country. Can you, in a nutshell, tell us, if you would summarize that experience for us, what do these national wounds look like from your experience as a journalist?
You know, we have the textbook understanding of what a national or an historical wound is. And it's an intergenerational pain that gets transferred because it's unresolved. And it manifests in various incarnations, whether it's in the development of destructive subcultures, overt violence, family dysfunction. But for me, my immediate sense of it was in a place called Lavender Hill. I went to do a story there, one of the casualties of forced removals, but also an incredibly creative, cohesive community. But what I found there was it was an incredibly traumatized community. And I sort of coined this term traumatization, the normalization of trauma, whereby, for example, you've got children who have been caught in the crossfire of gang violence on a daily basis. It's like a war zone. And yet when those guns start shooting and you've got these warring gangs competing for turf, the children's initial reaction is not the fright and flight, but it's to run towards the violence. And of course, then the tragedies unfold with just the most horrific injuries that children suffer, that families suffer. The wounds are not only physical, they're emotional, but it's become so much a part of daily life that there is a normality to the trauma. And I found that particularly disconcerting. I don't know if that encapsulates sort of my empirical understanding of it.
I like the term traumatization. Thank you for giving us a new word. We'll have to tip you every time we borrow your word. Your focus in that being on children and community. So I want to go to Dr. Omar and then to Dr. Ani. Dr. Omar, can you speak to, you've been in the children's sector for a long time. Dr. Omar is the director of the Teddy Bear Foundation. So Dr. Omar, if you can explain to us from children's trauma, but linking that to historical wounding, how does it look from your vantage point?
So I concur with what Hazel said, and I just want to say children are a microcosm of the macro structures. They are a reflection of what is going around us, happening, like Hazel said, running towards the violence, not running away from it. We've checked episodes in Orange Farm, the gangsterism, and how children are gravitating in order to protect themselves and their families. So children learn by what they observe. Observational theory, learning theory, I think speaks to that so evidently in what we are seeing on the ground. We are seeing, if we just look at the kinds of violations, children are engaging in Schedule 6 offenses. We're seeing murder, we're seeing sexual abuse, rape, the bullying, the cyberbullying, and the manifestations of that, the ripple effect, the outcome or the disastrous situations where children are resorting to attempted suicide and completed suicide. But if we just look at the whole mental health, because, you know, I read somewhere where it says that there is no health when there isn't mental health. And I think that is what we are currently faced with because of the intergenerational patterns of violence, looking at the historical landscape of the apartheid structure, looking at the security branch at that period of time where police were synonymous with violence, with fear, the anxieties, unfortunately impacted on families. And again, if we look at that perpetuating the cycle of fear and anxiety and, I think, retaliation, fighting against the dominance, the power that was subjecting families to oppression. And that is what we are seeing, where children, due to these unresolved issues, the conflicts, the unmet emotional needs, it's so complex, but you know, there are so many nuances in what they are depicting and how they are engaging and perpetuating the cycle of violence. It's a maladaptive behavioral response to what we are faced as a nation, as a country. So we're seeing a lot of rape. I want to just again speak to the statistics here, and it's not to alarm, but in the work that we've done, and since 2001, we work with young sex offenders, children who initiate sexual violence against other children. And as young as 5 and 6 year old children have engaged in attempted penetration and full-blown penetration, they've used blunt objects, forcing penetration. So that just speaks to the seriousness, the not only the complexity, but the confusion, the trauma that these children are faced with, and they're reenacting what they have been exposed to. But the reenactment is a gross violation. It's heinous crimes, which we would not expect children to engage with. So where does this come from? How does this result in behaviors that are not only unlawful, that are gross, and that are destructive behaviors? Mm. Now, for me, that is what we are dealing with. Unfortunately, that is the whole landscape of children in this country at the moment, where children are completely lost. They've lost the plot. They're not quite sure. And of course, as a nation, we have to look at establishing how to navigate this, to manage this differently. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Omar. So what I'm hearing between what Dr. Omar is saying and what Hazel is saying is that the violence it's in the water, right? It's the systemic violence that does stem from apartheid and potentially pre-apartheid years, because our history didn't start in apartheid. It's a 400-year-old country we know this duration of occupation. So the wounded history is hundreds of years old. It's not just the last 100 years or so. So I want to come to Dr. Ani. Dr. Ani's background does include a legal understanding, and as well as having worked in the South African NGO sector for 20 years. Dr. Ani, can you speak to what you see at community level? You worked in Orange Farm, Diepsloot, in the Western Cape as well. And for those who are not South African listeners, these are some of our most vulnerable communities in South Africa, peri-urban ones. Dr. Ani, can you give us your lensing on how this wound is visible in our communities today?
Well, thank you, Tracy. Having worked in the NGO sector for the last 15 to 20 years, especially in very deep peri-urban to rural communities, what we've seen is that we may have achieved civil and political rights. You know, people have freedom of movement, they have freedom of expression, but yet from a socioeconomic rights achievement, that's still very far away. And because people haven't seen the realization of their socioeconomic rights in many ways, you know, they are carrying, the effect of that means that they are carrying the anger, the bitterness of the past. And they haven't, a lot of people or some people have not been able to move past, you know, their perception of, mm-hmm. of what the future should hold for them and for their families. What we've also seen is a deeply broken family structure. Mm. And that perhaps plays out in terms of the anger, plays out in terms of the self. We often see people who self-sabotage. I wondered, you know, when people come into opportunities, you see that self-sabotage happen and you wonder why. I worked in an organization where we wanted to solve. We felt that until people are economically free, you know, they will continue to be subject to the politics of bread and butter and they will never be completely free.
Right.
So we went about trying to find employment opportunities for young people in particular. And it was at that time I realized that sometimes the problem is not the unemployment. The problem is the deep wounds that people carry. We found jobs for people and we put them in jobs and they walked out of the jobs by 11 o'clock. Mm. You know, after they get paid, they, first month they're out of that job. And I realized that it was that there is a brokenness. In human beings, in young people, in families, in mothers, you know, even if you look at our socioeconomic landscape, is we have a majority of a female-headed households with a lot of our males traveling out, you know, to go and look for work somewhere else, which is a historical pattern, amongst other things. So what we've experienced is for us to really heal, we've got to confront the trauma that we carry as individuals in our different environments. Mm.
Thank you. Whew. I try not to cry during these tapings, but some of the stuff, it hits straight into the heart. It's, and we can't be cerebral about these conversations. We have to speak to the head and the heart because if the head and the heart don't agree on the change, then the changes won't come. Thank you, Ani. That was a very raw and vulnerable, and I think tragically beautiful explanation. I want to go to Grant. Grant, you're a trauma-informed practitioner, and you work across different spaces, different sectors. So the subtext of the theme here today is it's national wounds, but what we're living with is the intergenerational trauma that has been caused by the national wounds and how the trauma lives not only within families and individuals, as Dr. Omar and Dr. Ani have explained, but within systems too, right? We see it at corporates. We see it in business spaces. We see it everywhere. Because no one who has lived here in the last 3 decades has gone unaffected by it. So as a trauma-informed practitioner, can you speak to how you've seen it play out in the spaces where you apply your work?
It's kind of a question where you think, how long do we have to talk about that? And, you know, because I've worked in communities, I worked in schools, I've been worked in prison. And so you see that play out in such multiple levels. So, you know, if we go for schools, for instance, not only do we have the historical nature of, under-resourced education in many schools. And so there's that structural violence that is still so current, that is a history of the past. But also how the trauma plays out in the classroom between learners and educators. Educators that are overwhelmed, burnt out, who may perhaps aren't resourced enough, and a system that overwhelms the educators. So there's this kind of passed on trauma, who was at Sandra Bloom, has spoken about something called trauma-organized systems.
Yeah.
And so where your systems reflect or mirror the trauma that we're trying to address. And so the same trauma that we're addressing in schools plays out in the way the schools function. You know, we see that within prison contexts, the same where wardens can sometimes behave just as much as badly as inmates do. And that's not a criticism of the wardens as much as it is a criticism or a reflection on the state of the system that traumatizes. Mm. And yeah, so to keep it brief, I think, you know, it runs, as you said, it's corporate. It's the levels of violence that play out at so many different, as those layers. And so violence being not something that's always physical or direct. There's a definition for violence I like to use, which is the illegitimate limitation of agency. And so I know that makes it quite broad, and yet it helps us to recognize how broad based violence really is. Yeah. And that is a consequence of the trauma that we haven't dealt with.
Yeah. I love that. So that's two new phrases that we will be borrowing from people. The illegitimate limitation of agency. So it's whatever means I apply to limit your agency, limit your freedom, limit you as a person. And in a not constructive way is sort of the subtext within that. Geez, thanks, Grant. That's a very useful phrase to add to our language. A big part of the work we're doing is trying to language these things in ways that become accessible to ordinary people. You know, we sit in, not necessarily us in the room, but there are ivory towers in the country where people sit with this holy knowledge. They think it's holy knowledge. And it doesn't help if that information's not in the hands of regular people. So I see the work here at the podcast and the other work that MWI does as starting to build languaging for things that we didn't have language for before. So when people are coining new terms, it excites me because it starts to build that linguistic picture. And then I'm going to move across to Martin. Martin's work at Matrix Men represents the men's sector, and the work is hugely focused with male survivors of all sorts of things. Male survivors of trauma, it includes domestic violence, sexual abuse, addiction, and other traumas. Martin, can you speak to how your experience in the men's sector is telling us how the past or the past traumas of the country are still living in their lives in the present day?
Wow. It's like you said, it goes back more than 100 years. It goes back to essentially industrialization, where fathers left their homes and left their wives and children and went off to earn money. And, you know, after a year or so, they got lonely and they found a girlfriend up in Joburg, and they kept sending the money back to the Eastern Cape. But their children there grew up without daddy, and so they've started another family up here, too embarrassed, so they don't go back home. Mm. And, you know, I mean, we have stories of kids as young as 8, 9 years old traveling alone from the Eastern Cape to find their fathers in Johannesburg.
Oh, wow.
They have no construct or no idea of how massive Johannesburg is.
Yeah.
But they head out on this venture to find their identity, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, so it's huge in that, as you said, 68% of homes in South Africa are fatherless. Mm. And for me, a lot of men are being raised not understanding this construct called masculinity.
Mm.
They also get the message in that masculinity is bad. It's toxic. It's, you know, and so the message in general that they're getting as young men is that they're just a problem, right? Kids as young as 8 are identifying in schools that they're a problem. I had an 8-year-old boy come to me the other day, and he said to me, "Why are we always guilty?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Boys are always guilty. We teach our sons not to hit girls, but we never teach our girls not to hit boys.
Mm.
We're always guilty." So boys are being raised with this construct that they're bad, they're evil, they're the problem, and they don't know how to deal with it. And it's expounded and it's magnified by the fact that they don't have a positive masculine role model in the home, right, to teach them. I mean, if we take the original construct of masculinity, it's a beautiful thing. It really is. You know, men are strong, they protect, they mentor, they provide, they take care of, and, you know, so we're there, but that's been cast as bad. So, you know, I mean, a lot of people are being accused of benefiting from patriarchy. I wasn't even alive when patriarchy was invented, you know. Why am I still to blame for it, you know? And this is the kind of thing we get. And so what we're finding is a lot of men just don't know how to voice their emotions. They don't know how to voice their problems and their pains and their things because we have this, you know, just shut up, cowboys don't cry, swallow it, move on, you know, it will pass. So we're taught not to talk about these things. Yet, as you said earlier, we need to vocalize these things. We need to give it a name. We need to start talking about it so that people receive permission through our stories and through our narrative to be able to talk about it. And that's when the healing process begins, right, in my opinion, right? So it's like my organization. I come from an abusive past. I was abused as a child, sexually, physically, from the age of 5 to 19. And I keep saying this, I tell my story to give other men permission to begin healing.
Right.
And that's it. And I think we need to change the constructs. We really need to, and start including men. And I'm glad to see over the last 13 years, there has been a move towards healing men. I think there's been a bigger drive to getting men into therapy and that sort of thing, which is a good thing. So yeah, still a lot of work to do. Still a huge amount of work to do. And we see things like mentorship programs flourishing for teens. I'm keen to start a troubled teen mentorship program. Mm-hmm. And we start the work one human at a time.
One human at a time. And so the phrase, I mean, it's a phrase we all know, you know, hurt people. Mm-hmm. And I think it's as true now as it ever was. And so when you're the son looking to a dad for that role modeling, but dad is wounded by his dad who was wounded by his dad, and we can go all the way back to the dark ages.
Yes. And that's proven by science now, right?
Right. Mm. And yeah, I mean, epigenetics is a whole other field of study, which we really do need to do a podcast on. Mm. But yes, intergenerational trauma is not just fancy phrasing. It's a scientifically proven fact now. We literally are inheriting the past in a very real sense. Ani, you looked like you'd wanted to contribute.
I wanted to contribute in two ways. The one is just highlighting that part of the illegitimate violation of agency, you know, as described, also manifests because the more agency is violated, the more subdued the person on the other side is holding back. And at some point, you know, they feel like they don't have a voice. And so we have a lot of, one of the challenges we currently see as part of the manifestation of that trauma is inability to exercise agency,
right,
inability to take control, to, you know, to have a voice, to recognize that your voice is important. And this is related generally in the human rights space as part of the connection to right human dignity,
yes,
to feel that I matter and that I have a contribution to make. And so we're struggling with that as a society. And we need to think through how do we help people to walk through that. We see that manifesting in the areas of mental health. And I want to agree with you, you know, very much. One of the things I work with a lot of boys and young men, and one of the big things we've heard is mental health. You know, we don't have outlets to be able to communicate. And it's a really a big challenge in terms of seeing how we can help young men and men to process the challenges that they have found themselves over the years.
And it's not even young men. I mean, there was a study done into the top 100 CEOs in South Africa, I think it was. And they said, what's the biggest problem that you face as a CEO? And they said, loneliness. We don't have friends. We've got nobody to talk to. So it's right through. There's just no spaces.
Yeah. Hazel, and then I want to introduce Putso, who has just joined us. Go ahead, Hazel.
Just very briefly, you've all encapsulated so eloquently the multi-layered beast that is historical trauma, be it political, be it social, be it sociocultural, be it familial, be it individual. But I think there's also the danger, of falling into a syndrome of victimology, whereby one justifies one's behavior or dysfunctionalism through the sins of the past. Yes. And I think there's a point at which we need to actually transcend that. And it's not just about sort of this sort of neoliberal sort of taking individual responsibility, but I really do think that it's not about letting go of the past at all. It's about acknowledging it, whether it's forced removals, whether it's unfinished business in the TRC, whether it's the emasculation of men and boys through this, whether it's unresolved anger. But I think at some point one has to transcend leaning back on, yeah. This has happened because of what came about through colonialism and apartheid, and really start looking at ways of going beyond in order to heal.
I loved it. It was Adler who said, what are you gaining from this? What are you gaining from this trauma? So people walk into your office and they go, well, you know, I'm suffering from depression. Well, it's, what are you gaining from it? What is this label depression giving you? So what is this apartheid label that so many carry, this wound, feeding them? What is it giving them? It is feeding them something. As difficult as that construct is to face up to, we're gaining something from it. You know, it's, you know, the wounded child. Oh, you know, my life is so tragic. I'm the victim. I'm a professional victim. So what are you gaining from that? Well, I gain acknowledgement. I gain acceptance. I gain care and empathy and understanding. And, and you're right, Hazel. We need to start dealing with it. We need to say, well, look, this happened. How do we move forward? We acknowledge the history. Let's move forward. Yeah. Otherwise, we're going to be like the Israelites walking around the desert for 40 years with a slave mentality.
I don't know if we want to talk about Israelites today.
Sorry.
No, but yes, let's not get lost as a nation. Is your point?
Yes.
I want to come to Dr. Omar for perhaps some lensing and insight on the question Hazel has posed us. If we're to be able to sit with Uncle President, whoever that may be at any given moment, what, Dr. Omar, advice would you give to the leader of the nation for moving forward? What might that look like?
Well, coming from the children's sector, nothing about us without us. And I think it's like you said, hurt children hurt other children. I think we need to understand that what we are, and I like the illegitimate, violation of agency, because what would we say to our president is actually listen to the people. And something that we've already addressed is we've looked, clearly I'm going to just say, we did a 5-year retrospective study on the conviction rate of children who had gone to court, over 5,385 cases. And of that, only 14% of the cases were finalized, 5% of convictions. And we've raised this at national, the Directorate of Public Prosecutions, law enforcement, bringing all the different government departments to the fore to bring it to their attention. And this is what we're lacking. There needs to be coordination. There needs to be collaboration. And of course, partnerships need to be put into folds here. Unfortunately, that's not what's happening. And that's what we need to bring to the attention of the president, that please, you know, work in synergy and listen to each other. Because if we look at the pieces of legislation as well, they're flawed. And some of it, if we look at the Children's Act, the Sexual Offences Act, the Child Justice Act, and we speak about age of sexual consent, 16, but termination of pregnancy, any age, surgical procedures, you need your legal guardian. So you could just see that these pieces of legislation are not speaking to each other. And we're faced with so many challenges. I mean, if we speak to what Hazel has said, just looking at the whole landscape of child pregnant learners, children, birthing children, a 10-year-old birthing a child, I mean, that's unheard of. That's when a child should be playing, hopping, skipping, laughing, jumping. And this is where we need to bring the president to say, please listen, see, you know, we are hurting children. So instead of hearing children, we are hurting them. And we need to give their voices a platform. That is what we need to do. We need to hear from them. What is the way forward? What is that? What is it that they need in order not to remain victims? Like Hazel said, this victimology, the past is the past. The past, it does impact on the present, but taking back that sense of power and control and moving forward in a different direction. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Omar. I just want to clarify on the stats you mentioned earlier, 5,000 and something cases. Those are cases where the children were victims. I just want to make sure that we are not talking about children as perpetrators. We're talking about children as victims. Indeed. All right. Thanks, Dr. Omar. Yeah. And the percentage of cases that even get to court is minute, and then the percentage of convictions is almost invisible. Shoo.
It speaks to the illegitimate violation of agency.
Precisely.
Yeah. Is the legitimacy? What systems failing children and families? That's what it is. The systems are inducing secondary victimization, further trauma. The wounds are so deep. It's the physical wounds disappear, but the emotional scars, psychological wounds continue. And then we see the knock-on effect generations later.
Absolutely. Yeah, those children grow up to become parents, and then goodness knows what the next generation is then, you know, vulnerable to. Dr. Omar, I know you have to love and leave us. Would you like to give us last words of wisdom before we let you go?
It is Sexual Awareness Month, and I think the one thing I always like to emphasize is on communication, dialoguing with children. And it's not a once-off isolated event. I think it's about speaking to it on a daily basis. So to all significant others, adults, parents, caretakers, please engage with children. Speak to what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. Demonstrate it so that they understand and allow them to speak. Because the approach we've had historically is that children are seen, are supposed to be seen and not heard. And it's about hearing children. I just think, let's listen. Give the voiceless a voice. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Omar. Been a privilege to have you on today. And we release you into the wild. Have an amazing day.
Thanks, Dr. Omar.
Thank you, everybody. Stay blessed.
Thank you. So we've been joined by Pitso from Safer South Africa. Welcome, Pitso. Pitso, we were just discussing the impact of our national wounds, and, you know, we started with apartheid, but we went back to colonialism because it really is that long of a history. So from the perspective of Safer South Africa and the work that you do in schools, how do you see the wounding of the country playing out in the spaces that you are working in?
You know, I heard what Dr. Omar said, but can I play the devil's advocate?
Go ahead. We want to hear your perspective.
The system is enabled by the adults within communities who are not hearing the children and who are not supporting the children as well. But the thing what the community, what our own community does, they are normalizing what is not right. And instead of encouraging people to come forward and become witnesses or testify for what they have seen, the only thing that is happening in our communities is that people who are in positions of power get support even though they are the perpetrators. And that in its continue to perpetuate the woundedness among the children, and those that have been hurt continue hurting others as a result. So we need to make sure that we are there for our children and support them in any way possible. But when it's colonialism and the woundedness, it becomes even severe to the parents themselves, that they do not really accept, they want to accept that whatever they experience is in the past, but there are still those triggers that contribute towards their well-being. You know, colonialism did not only affect us through the apartheid itself, but families were torn apart. And not because of them being forcefully removed, but my apology, but because of economic situations. I mean, if fathers had to go and work in mines kilometers away from home, come only home during Easter or a month end. So there was that gap between the fathers and the children, mothers and the children as a result. Hence we, I'm saying we, because I'm one of those who were raised by a maternal grandmom because my parents were not around as a result of colonialism. So that in itself has played a significant role in our life, and it determines where we wanted to go. But at the same time, you had to be strong. If you had a great grandparent, so to speak, that parent would have guided you. And weeping was the order of the day. We were not communicating, but weeping was the order of the day. But then we itself could have two impacts. Either you become the parent that continue using the rod as opposed to speaking to your children and guiding them well. And at some stages, you know, the day, first day, this day, an African and schooler, it was wet because we knew that Helakhan on Donor Pandak. And that in itself made other learners to quit school and others to run away from home because they did not spare the road those times. We were not even given hiding. It was not hiding. We were beaten, to be quite honest. Hence others manner in which they did. It was as a result of that. It had an impact, whether we look at it negatively or positively, but it did. But positively, it created an environment where people were scared of doing against the community or society or the law. But for others, they found it in which they could break the law.
But
in schools, it's happening at home, contributed towards bullying as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was just going to say that we see that translating in terms of how the tables have turned. When I was having a conversation with someone and they said teachers are petrified of students now. The order have twisted because now students are coming in, children are coming into schools with arms, with guns, with knives, and teachers are afraid. They cannot control their classes anymore. And that's effects of some of what Pitsu has just said.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just watching our time. So I want to do a round robin and the same question I'd asked Dr. Omar. If you could sit down with our uncle president, whoever that may be at any given moment, what word of advice would you give for the healing and essentially recovery of the country? So Hazel had put it beautifully. How do we get it together and move on? You know, not in a glib, dismissive way, but in a truly transformative way, move on from the wounding. So I'm gonna go to Grant first. Words of wisdom, Grant.
I think the place I'd want to start is looking at some of our key institutions across the country. So looking at education, looking at security, some of those key institutions, and saying, how do we need to do trauma work from the ground up? You know, so our police need, all of them need trauma-informed processes from their own processing, but also how they deal with those who are traumatized. Education, at the education level, we need to be resourcing the training of educators in trauma-informed ways of being. And again, that's both their own processes as well as being able to generate and create trauma-informed classrooms. We're talking even at engaging with business within the business sector. There's so much toxic stress across the business sector. Actually, we need to be engaging at that level, that at management level, they need to be bringing in trauma-informed ways of being.
Yes.
And we don't have time to really kind of go dig down in what does it mean to be trauma-informed. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. importantly, it's not about therapy per se. It's about creating cultures and structures that counter the trauma that is so present and how and ways of doing that. So it's really saying to the president, how do we resource properly in terms of doing it from the ground up rather than trying to do a lot of top-down thinking? And I think that's key. A lot of our work often is from the top down, which often doesn't make the change. And I, you know, it's kind of using the bottom up process within our brain for change and transformation of thinking bottom up. And that actually needs to be applied across the board. And so in short, that's what I would want is if I could sit down with him, that's what I would say.
So what I'm hearing you say is planning change with the end in mind and then sort of working backwards from that, right? So that's another way of thinking about a bottom-up approach.
I like not so much end in mind, but actually what direction we want to move. You know, it's kind of actually – it's about a direction we want to move in and being able to take actions that start that process.
Yeah. You know, in my head, the end in mind means that Oni and I and Dr. Omar and Pitso and Martin wake up one morning and go like, oh, the NGO sector is no longer required because our problems have been solved. We can now all go and lay on an island and drink teas and coffees and cocktails. So that's the beating heart for me of having an end in mind is imagine waking up one morning and It's the work is done. The healing is done. Hazel won't have any more tragic news to report. It'll just be all good things. Everyone won the lottery, you know, just all good things. So I'm going to, Grant, thank you. Thank you for the insight on that. I think if I was sitting with Mr. Prez, I would say the same thing. My guy, you need to look at your government from a trauma-informed lensing and the institutions and the systems, you know, it doesn't need a coat of paint. It needs a strip down and an overall like you would do with an old car.
Need one of those wrecking balls and just start again.
I mean, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. There may be some good things in the system still, but yes, an overall. Hazel, coming to you, same question. What advice would you give our leadership?
Okay, so picking up from what Grant said, you know, our president loves to use the word family gatherings when there's an important announcement. You know, he sort of likes to give it an intimacy. Well, our family, our national family, ideally should have gone on sabbatical in 1994 or gone for a family team building exercise to learn not only how to live with each other, but also to articulate anger, because that is, for me, still the residual effects and of apartheid, of colonialism, but also of a sense of betrayal, not by apartheid, a sense of betrayal by our own government, because we have lost trust in the very democracy. Although, as I said, I mean, on the other side of it, yes, our democracy is still intact. But the democratic institutions that were set up to protect us have failed us. And that's why the NGO sector is very much our safety net and lifeline. In the absence of a competent, corruption-free government. So come on, Daddy Cyril.
Yeah.
Be transparent. Be honest. Help restore our trust in you. And with that, of course, and then as Grant said, it's not a trickle-down process. There's also the process of building up from grassroots, from the very core of society, which is the family. But you can only do that with assistance and with a cross-sectoral, not a silo kind of approach. You've got to draw on all the government resources that are at your disposal, from education to health to early childhood development to help build a stronger, more resilient family fabric. And I know that sounds maybe a bit Pollyannish because it's far more complex than that. But I think that's the place to start. It's to restore trust in the very government that we voted into power, in the very government that promised a better life for all and has not delivered.
I think that's endemic to what we're facing, is that we've not empowered the people. We've empowered a select few to absolute wealth, stinking wealth. I mean, and we've just seen more unemployment. I mean, if we look at the basis of trauma, I mean, the 10 that are given us in the adverse childhood experiences, mm-hmm. poverty is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, violence is another. I mean, I went to do a talk in Davyton at a town called Itwatwa.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that's a nice name. And then somebody explained the name to me. It's the sound a gun makes. Twa, twa.
Mm.
And children are being raised in this environment. And we expect them to just be normal kids yeah. when they're adults, you know. So we're just breeding violence.
Mm.
It's endemic. And then there's, of course, addiction in the family, depression in the family, incarceration. And then, of course, sexual, physical, whatever, abuse. And we know that close on 40% of all children have suffered some form of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're expecting to raise a happy, healthy yeah, generation.
Those children become parents. Yeah, and then
they
what
become
do we
parents
do?
And they just play that out.
Yeah. Know?
So if I were to advise the president, my advice would be to lead. And to lead. I think we Sorry. Need leadership that would do everything that we've started speaking about today, that would acknowledge, you know, what we've been through and going through as a nation. But at the same time, encourage everybody else, you know, to start exercising the agency and to say no when agency is being violated, you know, to take some positive steps towards the future that we want to bring.
Hmm.
But beyond that, the president has a lot of influence to also raise leaders across various sectors, leaders in the corporate, leaders to lead with kindness. I think one of the things we've lost is that leadership with kindness.
Mm.
The more people that are standing up and saying, we want to do things differently without losing, you know, a sight of where we've come from, but focusing on where we want to go and where we want to be, which is the end in mind that we spoke about. That would be what I think there's not enough people who are leading us and taking really strong stands on issues of this nature. So it's one thing that, and oftentimes we focus on what that means for us in terms of what happened in the past, but we're not necessarily, you know, leveraging that to say this is the potential possibilities that exist when we take the steps that we, so we need to raise leaders everywhere.
Yeah.
Mm. That's really in what I would advise the president with. His power, his influence, his ability to take this country forward depends on how he leads and especially with kindness.
Mm. And on the topic of leaders, how many of the current leaders in government are themselves the people who were shot at or held guns or were in exile and had come back or were in prison? So the trauma they carry is profound. And then, of course, now you're bleeding on 56, I don't know how many people we are now, 56 million. You're bleeding on 56 million other people in the way you make policies, in the way you do and don't implement them. Usually it's a don't on that, on the way you make laws that contradict each other, you know. So I almost want, Hazel, on your topic of family, I want to take the whole government and take them on a retreat. And it's like, guys, can we just deep dive your personal trauma as individual human beings and then come back and do what Ani has suggested, now lead from a place of real consciousness and being trauma-informed and being aware of how you show up. Yeah, and trust, and building trust.
Mm. That's why I use the word kindness.
Yeah.
Because kindness recognizes that, you know, even perpetrators of violence against others at some point change. And you can't always, you know, as much as you want to hold accountable, but you can't tie them to their past either. You know, we believe in this massive conversation around Ubuntu.
Yes.
I exist because you are, and you are because I am. So if we want to move forward, we've got to get to a point and say South Africa belongs to everyone who is in it.
Mm.
And if South Africa belongs to everyone who is in it, How can we recognize the trauma I carry, but I'm not constantly poking your eyes and saying, because you created that trauma, I am not going to let go and I'm going to make sure. And that's why we're carrying huge anger and we have huge distrust, and we've got to turn around and say, how can we raise leaders? We see it in corporate. Mm. Everyone is on edge. Mm. So how do we get to a point where we move past, and I hear you, move into private family meeting, but kindness at the base of our leadership, and absolutely raise others who can support that.
Yeah. Thank you, Ani. Go ahead, Putso.
Humanity at the base of our existence. Because if we could care about the next person, then are we?
Yeah.
What kind of leaders are we? I would sit down and say to him, President, may you please kindly stop lying. You and your leaders stop to the community.
We love because
our kids are now prone and are now aware that you've got leaders that are not truthful and that are economical with the truth. We live in an environment where sewer is the order of the day, where people don't have water, where learners are leaving school because there is no water at school, where there is no electricity. And there are a host of other things that need to be done. And we live in an environment or in a society where unemployment is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And yet expecting educators to do miracles at school.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
business as usual. It's business unusual. You know, previously, what we would do as educators, we would develop a child holistically. As an educator, you would go extra mile and do extra curriculum. I was in charge of debate. There were educators that were in charge of as well. But now it's different. It's on academic. And we are saying the focus is on academic without extracurricular. But at the same time, we are saying learners must pass with 30%, must pass with 40%.
Mm.
Yeah.
They are not getting access to tertiary institutions as a result. So what I would say to him would be, can we please look at the education system holistically? We have children that are traumatized, that come from families where there is nothing. Some, the only meal that they get is at school.
Mm.
But we need such those learners to concentrate and to achieve academically.
Mm.
Why don't we try to develop them holistically in making sure that we bring in social workers at school? Don't let teachers be social workers. Let there be people who will come and be able to address learners on issues that need social workers, people that are trained as that.
Yeah.
Because educators are not trained as that. We try, but we majority of time fail. Mm. And if you want to see the product that is not well from the education side, you will meet them in jail, in correctional services.
Mm.
So the people, we would say as educators, we have failed.
Yeah.
And if it fails, obviously you will get them at a morgue.
Yeah. I mean, we need to have a whole separate podcast about prisons. I actually want to do that. We do some work with men who are reintegrating back into society post having served their prison term. And I think it's one of those spaces that we politely get to ignore as a society, but we cannot, because when those people come out of that system, they're potentially coming out more wounded than when they went in.
Mm, and they live among us.
And are actually just trying to get a job and be like normal people, but the system is stacked against them from the start. So that's a whole conversation we definitely need to get into. But we're out of time, folks. So I'd like to thank everyone, and I'm just going to maybe just wrap us up with try to consolidate the ground we've covered today. I think we're in a position where the most vulnerable in society is still paying the price for broken systems, right? We're talking about children. And when I step back and say the most vulnerable society, I don't think that there is a person who has not suffered in a sense because of the system, right? Across races, across age groups. I think the suffering is a shared suffering, and it might be more pronounced in some places and demographics than others, but there's not a person who's living in this country and is untouched by it. Mm. And so I think it's very much still playing out now. We've agreed amongst us that it needs to start with leadership. So it needs to start at the top, but using Grant's analogy, with a bottom-up approach. Mm. So having the leadership really think about the masses of people and not only about their own power and influence and potential for wealth generation in those spaces. And then appreciating that a lot of our leaders were still at the hot end of apartheid. You know, they were very much, I was born after, but they were very much present to it. And so their wounding is real and raw. And I think they had all lost people in the struggle. And so yes, they are inadvertently bleeding on the nation. But you don't know until you know. So maybe it's up to people like us to help them understand that it's time to have these trauma-informed conversations and employ trauma-informed approaches. Because unfortunately, the system that's making the rules is still the system that carries the wound. So the wound is literally written into the code. It's written into the system. Mm. It's written into every policy. And so, yes, there's a great deal of work to be done. I want to thank everyone for making time today. I think we had a very profound and robust conversation. And I think we could sit here for days talking about this and not get to the bottom of it. But we've covered good ground. So, Martin, thank you. Ani, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Pitso, thank you for joining us. Your insights in the education space has been invaluable. Grant, you need to write a paper about that bottom-up approach and send it, email it to Uncle.
I'll help you.
Yeah, I mean, the practical application sits in Grant's work. Otherwise, it's just theoretical talk. Grant's an expert on how it actually works in the system. Hazel, your insights, the award-winning journalist that you are, and author now as well, have been beautiful. I think you provide insights that none of us could ever have hoped to have, because we see the world from one perspective and you've got this beautiful overarching view. Thank you for sharing that with us today.
I think what I've been left with after this incredibly diverse yet related discourse is a sense also, first of all, of the expertise of each of the participants, the confluence of the notion of trauma, and the fact that it does emanate from so many different sources, be they, as I said, political, socioeconomic, cultural, personal, but also based on the participants' expertise and perspectives, the way of hopefully transcending this culture of, as I said, traumatization, that our country, our beautiful, brave, courageous, and irrevocably cruel country has become so attuned to, and going beyond the notion of victimology as being what defines us, to something that we have overcome and transcended to become a truly healthy democracy.
For me, the conversation is again kind of providing a sense of hope for the fact that there are so many people that are engaged in this space and are aware of the depth of trauma. And that ultimately is really the essence. So bringing hope, recognizing that an hour-long conversation, we're only really touching the surface, but it's helpful to know that there are people engaged in these processes. Because it's cycles of trauma, we've spoken about that, and for us to see the change and the healing and the hope that we want to see in the country, disrupting that cycle of intergenerational trauma is so important. And we don't do it by doing it in sectors, we do it by transforming our own hearts, our own lives, and institutions. And I think that's what's come out of the conversation, is that it's not a simple one space that we do it in. That definition I use of the legitimate limitation of agency is by a author called Vigh, V-I-G-H, just in case I don't want to claim like it was my definition, but it's one I have used, but I just wanted to put it out there.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Heal Your Mind with me, Chasey Kotzen. We'll see you soon.
Heal Your Mind podcast with Tracy Kotzen is hosted by Mental Wellness Initiative and supported by the Ford Foundation.